Hello and welcome to the Monocle Winter Weekly on Monocle 24. In the chairs, me, Tom Edwards and Henry Rees-Sheridan.
For the next few weeks, we'll be celebrating the release of Monocle's new newspaper, The Winter Weekly. As fine a name for a paper as a radio show, if ever I heard one.
On today's programme, we'll be getting ready for the holiday season with Patricia Michelson. She, the founder of La Fromagerie Cheese Shop. She'll be stopping by, it's only round the corner, to talk us through some of the finest cheeses to enjoy this winter.
We'll also be hearing from Monocle's very own Melkan Çarçoğlu'yan about his trip to Tromsø in Norway's far north. He went there to meet members of the Sami community who work with reindeer on a daily basis.
Plus, we'll meet Brett Wollstonecroft of London favourites Daunt Books. He'll be bringing a towering pile of good reads that should be finding their way under any self-respecting Christmas tree.
All that plus some good music as well, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So, Henry, here we are again in the Monocle Weekly chairs. They're comfortable and, we try and give our listeners a flavour of the dynamics here at Midori House. It's been busy, hasn't it, upstairs?
Dynamic is the word, Tom. I've been somewhat sheltered from most of the activity, being as I am on the other side of the room to where most of the magazine team sit. They've been awfully busy.
They have, and it very much takes me back. I used to work on a daily newspaper, in fact, and we had our weekly siblings alongside us. But I must admit, although I'm sure our magazine colleagues won't thank me for saying, I do like the dynamic. There's something about a bustling newsroom, and there's something about the joys of newsprint.
I'm sure you enjoy it more as a spectator sport than as a participant.
True. Well, no, but also listeners to programmes like The Stack will know we love our newsprint here. The Monocle Summer Weekly newspapers were a great success and, of course, I think hastened the return for this winter version, which is all tremendously exciting. And the first issue hit newsstands on Thursday, another one next week. Very exciting.
Tom, has your column returned this time round?
So in the summer, I did pen a radio column, which was lots of fun. They haven't asked me back. Read into
interesting.
That. Read into that what you will. I'll tell you somebody, though, who's penning a most interesting column each week, and that's our own editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. And there's going to be a chance not only to read it in the beautiful pages of the Monocle Weekly, but to hear it, of course, here on the Monocle Winter Weekly show. But, Henry, rather than have me blather on about it, shall we hear the column itself? Here he is.
We'll start today with a thank you and a tack, grazie, danke schön, merci, and arigato gozaimasu to all those Monocle and FT readers who took the time to write to me over the past 2 weeks to express how their weekends wouldn't be quite the same without my 836 words in the pink paper and that their Saturdays and Sundays would be upended forevermore. I promise I don't exaggerate. Never. For a few days, I tried my best to stay on top of the emails and responded to readers in Dallas and Hong Kong, Ottawa and Stockholm, but there have been so many, and still they come, that I haven't been able to get back to everyone individually. As I have a couple of long-haul flights before settling down for Christmas, I will most definitely get back to everyone, but in the meantime, I thought it was more important to do this. Get back to the business of penning a column. So what have I been doing for the past 2 weeks? Rather a lot. There was my birthday. Thank you again to those who remembered. And no, it was not a birthday of particular significance. There were a lot of meetings with our architect in Zurich for our new HQ. More on that a little bit later. Finishing the forecast, out next week. And organizing the launch of Monocle's Winter Weekly, our second foray into the newspaper business this year, with some significant journalistic production and logistical tweaks. As with the Summer Weekly, we'll be coming off-press every Tuesday, but this time it's Switzerland rather than Italy in charge of printing, and from there the paper will be dispatched direct to subscribers via Swiss Post subsidiary, so we're hoping for a timely delivery into letterboxes across Europe. For the rest of the world, the Winter Weekly should touch down in time for the weekend and will also be sent to select newsstands around the world, hopefully in time for Saturdays in most markets. If you're reading this on fine newsprint this very moment, then I'm hoping the logistics have worked in everyone's favour. If you're reading this on screen but would like the full delights of a three-section paper, then bundle up and head to your favourite newsstand, or simply go to monocle.com/subscribe to get all the editions across December. Then again, it might just be easier to listen, as you're doing now. Just as complex as launching a newspaper was the seventh edition of the Monocle Christmas Market that took over Midori House last weekend. There were snorting, snuffling reindeer for photo ops, and the Swedish Lucia Choir did a mix of traditional and jazzy numbers to get visitors in the mood for the season. In between, the Swiss embassy was on hand with emergency supplies of raclette and wines from Canton Vaud. The Czechs had some fine Bohemian crystal on display. Sud Tirolers were offering up rugged felt backpacks. And regular Monocle contributor Nancy Durham was back with a refreshed lineup of lavender items for feet, hands and tired temples. With door takings going to the Committee to Protect Journalists, the response from visitors was that our little market was not only the best slice of Middle European Christmas in the heart of London, clearly a very competitive field, but also a good example of bringing together entrepreneurial businesses to show off their finest wares in a format that should live across the year. "Could you do this every weekend?" asked a visitor from North London. "It's a very effective way of shopping when everything is so compact and focused." While we're not going into the business of launching mini malls just yet, it does serve as a small example of what consumers are looking for in a retail market that seems wholly consumed with the online threat and the death of traditional shops. It also reminds me of what happens when large corporate players start to plot out their own demise. Rewind 10 years ago, and I recall a meeting with the publisher of a weekly magazine that had predicted the end of print within 6 to 7 years and an industry-wide bear hug embrace of the tablet by both readers and advertisers. One chart that was shared revealed a crossover point circa 2014 that was going to see more people reading magazines on tablets than in print, and that this would be close to the point that his company was going to be turning off their presses and enjoying a lower-cost, logistics-light business. It will come as no surprise that this has not happened, and the magazine in question is still printing in plants around the world because readers didn't want to be pushed into a place that was uncomfortable and not in line with their reading habits. This is where retailers need to pay attention and not speed toward a world where they exit high streets and malls and only exist on screen. Just as many a media company thought it would be a bump for the bottom line by getting out of buying paper and cutting print contracts, many retail companies are making a similar mistake by thinking about how profitable they'll be by abandoning hundreds of shops and opening up logistics hubs in remote regions. In many parts of the world, this is the time of year when streets come alive and there's a wonderful buzz of commerce, community and charity that can only happen when humanity is shuttling between shops, enjoying a warm drink in front of a chalet and admiring the twinkling lights of a well-appointed city centre. High marks this year for Zurich's Bahnhofstrasse. The Christmas spirit doesn't happen in a backlit world in quite the same way it does in an ancient town square or even a parade of newly renovated shops. Stores, bank branches, and even travel agencies all have a space and a role to play in city centres and suburban neighbourhoods. They just need to be right-sized and reconfigured, make that perhaps more intimate, to be relevant to the modern consumer. For Monocle, This Week in Toronto, I'm Tyler Brulé.
Thank you very much, Tyler. Indeed, Henry, you and all of our other listeners and readers can read the column each week for the next month and get your Christmassy vibes on, or hear it by listening to this programme or heading to the relevant page at monocle.com.
Tom, I think I'll do both. Now, are you ready to get redolent?
I think I was born ready.
It's cheese time.
It's the time of year when many will be gathering friends for a get-together, a drink and a tasty bite to eat, or two, or ten if you're me. Now, there may be some who argue that all cheese is good cheese, and we're not about to debate that. But some are certainly a little better than others.
Patricia Michelson is someone who knows which ones those are. She founded a collection of renowned London stores specialising in cheese under the name La Fromagerie, and we're very pleased to say there's one just around the corner from the studio.
And it's always a pleasure to have Patricia with us here at Midori House, and she joins us again today. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Patricia. Super to have you with us. And I did mention as we were readying ourselves that you may be my favourite guest of the year, simply because you have arrived, and we should paint the picture in words for our listeners, positively laden with cheeses.
Yes, it's always good to come armed.
And there's some, how can I describe it? There's some fragrance in the air as well in Studio One, isn't there, Henry?
The olfactory impact is already keenly felt among the inhabitants here at Studio One, at least on this side of the glass. Where should we begin? I don't really know.
Well, I'm interested a bit. There's a sort of a festive note to our introduction, Patricia. I mean, how big of a deal is the sort of Christmas period cheese-wise? Because presumably people are making some investments they perhaps wouldn't otherwise make during the year. What sort of happens to the cheese dialogue at La Fromagerie in the build-up?
Well, if I can tell you that we bring in, just for the Christmas period, about 2 tons of cheese in our little business.
Okay.
That gives you some idea of what Christmas means
Patricia,
to us.
That's a lot of cheese.
That is a Laura cheese, yeah.
And I wonder, do people want to sort of push the envelope and experiment and go on a crazy, cheesy journey?
They
or is
do.
It old favourite?
It's the time of year where you're getting loads of people round and family, friends, and you're all pushed together in a room where you never see each other any other time
and
collectively.
Perhaps you're sad about that. Perhaps you're glad about it.
Yeah. A lot of arguments take place, etc. But when it comes to the cheese board, you're trying to think, oh, I want to please Auntie May, I want to please Uncle Bert and all the rest of it, and I want to please myself. So they tend to sort of go completely bonkers, and we have to rein them in, as it were, and say, come on, let's calm down, dear. Let's get a proper selection together.
Patricia, I'm interested. People have different cheese conventions, ways of consuming it, and their own favourite times and methods. For you, how should cheese fit into the anatomy of Christmas Day?
It's an integral part. Usually it's best to have it right at the end. Follow a more British tradition of serving food and have it with a specific wine or a port so you keep it towards the end of the day. But you don't have to have it per se part of the meal. Have it later in the afternoon or early evening when you've had a little snack,
walk, and exactly post,
you know,
sleep
post
snack.
Sit down, you know, you've listened to the Queen ad hoc, whatever, and you just want to have something to enjoy together, and that's where cheese comes into its own.
And Patricia, on that, to some convention busting fashion of recommending cheese last, and you mentioned wine there. Now, I'm not averse to enjoying even a very fine cheese with, for example, an outstanding champagne. Happy bedfellows,
oh,
I would say. But some people are very particular. Is this a broad enough church that we can welcome one
you
and
can
all?
Welcome absolutely anything you like. And nowadays, the whole convention of tasting plates, tasting small plates, this, that and the other, trying out gin with cheese, you know, vodka with cheese. It all actually works if you know what you're doing. And I brought a cheese along today, for instance, which is the truffled brie, which is something of a delight in La Fromagerie, and that's perfect with a dry champagne.
Well, here we go.
Should we start?
Enough talking, Patricia. Let's start with that. Now, well, should we start with that?
Let's start how you should go round a cheese board.
Perfect.
So you start first with something that's more palate cleansing and lighter. So you start with a goat's cheese, and I've got one here which is called Ruelle, and it's a round cheese with a hole in the middle.
It almost looks like some kind of artifact from a bygone civilization, doesn't it? It's astonishing looking.
I've just given you half. So the reason why they've got the hole in the middle is that they don't waste it. They sell it as a tiny little cheese, the little middle bit. But because you've taken out the middle bit, you're helping the cheese to ripen because it's quite thick. So it would take forever to ripen. So you start with a goat, which is more palate cleansing, fresh and tangy. And that sort of clears your taste buds from all the other exotic things that you've been eating throughout the meal, and it gives you a nice fresh start.
Now, I shall caution our listeners, Henry's going to tackle this upon one of your excellent charcoal biscuits, so that will be an astonishingly loud crunching sound. Fit your boots, Henry. I'm going to try it au naturel like this.
Okay.
As in, I'm not au naturel, the cheese, I mean.
It's fresh. Slightly. It's a bit cold. It's a cold day today, so I walked around and it seemed to get colder, the cheese. But it's got this lovely fresh fudgy taste to it.
That's almost as you're
sort of allowing it to melt in the mouth. It's cleaning the mouth, ready for the next taste.
And I can really feel that would perfectly round off the excesses of Christmas pudding from a little earlier.
Yes.
All
can
that
you imagine?
Huge richness.
Yes. Yeah.
Really, and really sweep away the cobwebs.
Exactly.
In there.
Yeah. And put a good coat of primer down.
It's lovely to have a little bit of goat's cheese at the end of the day as well. Before, if you've forgotten your toothpaste, wherever you are, have a little bit of goat's cheese. It actually cleans your teeth.
More great advice. I'm changing up generally. Yes. I'm not going to forget the toothpaste. I'm never taking it again.
Yes, my dentist approves, I assure you.
There you go.
So that started you off. So you're already wanting, I need to taste something else. I need to taste something more. So let's go to Sweden.
Okay, now, this is very exciting. I'm feeling
exciting,
positively more Christmassy already.
Yes.
The Nordic region.
The Nordic.
Nordic
cheeses are a big story. And they will be the big story of 2018, where you will see more of them coming into the market because there are now more young and independent cheese making going on in Sweden and Norway now.
Great.
Which has been lacking for many, many years. So
Patricia,
this is,
why is that? Sorry, before we jump in.
Because it's the government. The government took control of the dairy industry, and they controlled the cheese making. So it was just, you know, pounding out loads of just very, you know, ordinary cheeses under, you know, with lovely exotic Swedish or Scandinavian names. And they have now allowed individuals to start cheese making again.
The cold burn of the market has entered the Nordic cheese realm. Is that what you're telling me?
It's very interesting. There's much more to it than that. But the Rangabastost, which I've got here, which is this one, do help yourselves and cut.
Over here?
One.
Am I pointing to... Okay, great. I'm going to...
It's a hard cheese. It's a
Anton.
Bit like a Swedish Emmental without the holes. It's
okay.
Got little holes, but not
so
not
we're
vast
presumably.
Ones.
I'm looking forward to this, and we're presumably looking for that sort of nuttiness, that slightly. Oh,
yes,
thank you very much.
Yes, it is. It's from southern Sweden, and it's one of the oldest styles, old fashioned styles of cheese, and. Thomas Berglund, who is the cheesemaker, is a fantastic man who has resurrected his family dairy farming. They've been there since, I think, the 16th century and has created cheeses now back to how they used to be made.
And I know we should be purely objective and, in a sense, divorce the stories behind the cheese from the simple act of tasting. But there's no question that when you have that kind of heritage or that return or a boost for independent cheese making, it definitely adds a note of extra deliciousness.
You know, my favourite word to end the year is authenticity. When things are authentic and they taste of what they should be tasting, then you know you're getting something special. And this is what we want to have with anything, whether we're buying a coat or eating a piece of cheese.
Patricia, my mouth is full. But I have a question.
I was off
Tom,
mic
maybe,
as well as I leaned in for more.
There's such a lovely sweetness coming through, isn't there, with this one?
I was just about to say, so sweet. I'm interested in getting your views on rind. To eat, not to eat. Frequently, I can't tell, frankly, when I'm confronted with a new cheese about what my approach towards it should be. Are there any rules of thumb that me and my listeners can follow?
Yeah. Something like the Rangabastos, for instance, has a hard rind to it. You wouldn't necessarily want to give that to yourself to eat, but your dog or your animal or your rabbit might absolutely love it.
Or what about a less popular member of the Christmas party? Human?
Well, no, some people do eat them because cheese ripens from the outside into the centre. So all the most exotic flavours are at the very edges of cheese. So if you really wanted to sort of chew away at that rind, please do, because you will get even more flavour sensations as you're eating it. But there are some cheeses, like the Stilton, for instance, that has a pitted sort of biscuity crust on it, and that's because it has cheese mite on the outside, which is part and parcel of the cheese, and which we control. We don't let it take over and burrow into the cheese. But you wouldn't necessarily want to eat that, although some say that adds to the whole flavour. So it's really and truly up to you.
It might add a little to it, one might say.
It could.
Forgive me for my punning. All these delicious cheeses bring out the worst in my punning tendencies.
Yes, I mean puns galore.
That really is quite excellent.
Yes, so let's now
how to follow it.
Go on to something really traditional and a Keen's cheddar. And this is a lovely family farm. The whole family are involved with the cheesemaking process here. And this is what I call a proper British cheese. It's a West Country cheddar. There's only a few people that actually can say, a few cheesemakers that can actually say they make a West Country cheddar that's got the AOC, you know, it's got the authority to be made in that place using milk from their own herd to a recipe that is a traditional recipe. And this is a classic.
And I guess these days, more and more of the cheeses we're talking about here are subject to that appellation contrôlée, whatever you want to call it. There's EU rulings, which, I mean, that's for another day, I guess, the question of how that, what happens with that post-Brexit, etc. But that's presumably very good. And it serves presumably to safeguard a lot of these quite niche independent makers who perhaps otherwise could be threatened by the sort of mass market.
And it's very interesting. It's a French expression, you know, appellation contrôlée. But I hasten to add that the French are being really tardy in preserving their heritage, i.e. their camembert. Where I don't think there's a single farm that's left in the village of Camembert actually making camembert. It all goes to a big cooperative, all the milk. So they are effectively destroying their heritage.
Yeah.
Patricia, let's talk about English cheeses. I absolutely love cheddar. I would almost go as far as to say that it might be my favourite cheese category.
This one's got a lovely little sting
of them all.
I was going to say, there's almost a warmth to it.
Yeah,
that comes
warmth,
through.
But a little sting on your tongue.
Mm. I'm interested. So, one of my favourite George Orwell essays is a lesser-known one, and it's called In Defence of English Cooking. Yeah. And in it, he identifies specifically English cheeses as being one of the overlooked facets English cuisine.
Yeah.
Do you think that's he's justified in that view? Are English cheeses overlooked? He preferred a Stilton. What do you think of English cheeses? How have they changed over the years, and what are your favourites?
Yes, if he was living now, he would be so happy. He would be enthralled with how much cheese making is going on in England and how it has changed and evolved and become this incredible selection of cheeses that you can get, from goat's cheese to washed rinds to hard cheeses to sheep's cheeses, you name it, they're now being made, but by young people, by people that are going back to the land. This is what it has been lacking in his time. But now you're seeing it evolve and a blossom. It's just
how
amazing.
Wonderful. I sense that might be one of the relatively few things that would delight him if he was still here. But nonetheless, he could celebrate the cheeses. Let's rattle on through
right,
our cheese board. Where next?
Let's go over here. We're going to Portugal. It's from Alentejo. I think it's that how you call it? But anyway, southern Portugal. And this is a really soft, squidgy cheese made with sheep's milk. You need to put that on a little biscuit.
I'm going to convey it over to Tom now.
The reason why the flavour is so interesting is because the rennet, the coagulant that they use to separate the curds, is a thistle rennet. So it's not only vegetarian, it's got this incredible flavour coming from the thistle. An artichoke thistle rennet. The thistles are put into the milk and they naturally coagulate the milk into curds. And the sheep are grazing on areas of the land that have got lots of thistles in them anyway.
That almost takes a farm.
That's quite extraordinary.
Doesn't it?
And it sort of disappears whilst you're still searching to identify some of those trace flavours. That's absolutely remarkable, isn't it? Very unusual.
Yes, and so at Christmas it's sometimes nice to have something that's a little bit out of the ordinary, so that when you're all sitting down together, they'll be saying exactly what you're saying. My goodness, why does that taste like that? And you can have a nice conversation, you know, with the family.
Fabulous. Patricia, time is against us, so we must do
a quick fire sample
of the last couple.
This is the moment we've all been waiting for,
isn't it? I want Henry to sample this huge piece that you've sliced.
What am I just about to eat?
You're eating a brie, which we fill with a truffled cream.
Oh, great. And
it looks almost like a cake, Patricia. And you're recommending the charcoal biscuits to me.
Yes,
is that right?
You? Yes.
There you go.
I'll pass this over.
Thank you, Patricia. This looks absolutely
delicious. So this is what you can have with your champagne.
If you're on a sort of calorie control option, or what's it called, if you've got...
Don't worry.
Don't worry.
Absolutely just don't worry, because you're not going to eat a huge amount of this. It's
potent stuff, isn't it?
Yes. Oh,
that is extraordinary.
Wow.
I'm not even going to be able to finish the slice that you
well,
served me.
Well, you've got the rest to share with your friends.
Fantastic.
Afterwards. And finally, we always finish off with a blue. So
why is that?
Because the blue picks up all the different elements that have gone around the table, from the spicy to the rich, the creamy, the earthy. And then you've got those lovely blue metallic threads going through the Stilton that will actually sort of bounce off all those flavours that are in your mouth. And that's a beautiful Colston Bassett Stilton.
From
Nottingham.
From Nottingham.
Yeah. That's Christmas.
That's Christmas on a plate.
Exploding Christmas.
Yes,
right there.
Yes. But by, having them in that order, you know, going from the fresh to the crumbly to the rich and creamy to the spicy and then finishing with the blue, you've actually made that nice little sort of profile journey that works all together.
Patricia, it has been a cheese-powered journey of delight.
I only wish that we might have had some wine, of course.
I was tempted to, but I thought this might actually turn into something else.
Yeah, other than a little
discussion.
Well, I should urge people to, of course, come and visit any number of your outposts. Indeed, they can read about a recent addition to your family.
Yes, we're in Bloomsbury.
Just across the way in Bloomsbury, here in London Inn.
Yeah.
A recent addition, I think.
We're just coming up to, I think, 8 weeks.
So very new and exciting. If you're anywhere nearby, do pay a visit. Patricia Michelson, a master of cheese,
can tell you more. Well, I wish you all a very happy Christmas.
And to you, Patricia.
And
thanks
you, Patricia,
so much.
Thank you for coming in.
See you. Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Winter Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Henry Rees-Sheridan. Henry, I think it's time for a tune. We're going to be hearing from one of our intrepid reporters, Malcolm Chachoglian, about his trip to visit reindeer herders in northern Norway in just a moment. And believe you me, that's worth hearing. But should we have something to get us in the mood first?
I think so. Here's a classic from Broadcast with Winter Now.
Snow lies all around. There's no sense of doubt. You are the only one to keep me sane when all is wrong. Oh, my heart waits in winter now.
The sound of the much missed Trish Keenan there with Broadcast. That was Winter Now from back in 2003. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Now, the Winter Weekly, Monocle's new four-part newspaper, is on all good newsstands now, featuring stories ranging from skiing in Georgia to design in Vienna. You can subscribe for your copy and find out much, much more at monocle.com.
One of the stories in this week's edition, Tom, sees Monocle's Malcolm Chachoglian heading to Tromsø, the city in the Arctic Circle in northern Norway, to learn how its economy gets things done during winter months.
While there, Malcolm met with the local Sami community to learn the ropes of reindeer herding.
In Tonsvik, across the fjord from Tromsø, one of Norway's northernmost cities and deep inside the Arctic Circle, a 200-strong herd of reindeer are noisily munching away on dried moss and grass pellets. Their dusty brown coats stand out brilliantly against the snowy linen land. Looking after these creatures are the Sami, a people indigenous to northern Scandinavia, Finland and parts of Russia. They've been herding reindeer, fishing and hunting in these parts for some 5,000 years. Though much of Sami life has changed over that time, for some of the population, herding reindeer remains the lion's share of their livelihood. Luna, a fire-haired Sami shaman, calls them to feed with a distinctive sound. The herd produces ample stocks of meat, milk and fur, necessary resources in a region where minus 30 degrees Celsius is the norm. And what the visitors don't see are the other animal predators stalking the tundra. Andre, who is busy chopping wood as we approach him, always has this lurking menace on his mind.
This herd I keep inside this perimeter for protection. But the rest of the family has their herds in the mountains and they go up every day during wintertime with snowmobiles, herding them, looking after them, feeding them if they need to. If it's a bad winter, like now with a lot of ice, then of course you have to go up feeding them every day and herding them. And that you do all day, every day, all week. Of course, we have a lot of predators, like lynx and wolverine, that will kill a lot of reindeers during wintertime. And then you will have another problem during springtime. For example, I can take example, for a lynx can take one reindeer every second day. So that means it takes a lot of reindeers during wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we herd them a lot, both in the mountains and put them in fences like that for protection, because this is what we make money off, the meat and skin. And if we lose a lot of reindeers to lynx or other predators, we won't make money.
The reindeer's hide is particularly valuable as it's used to make the thick boots and trousers sported by many Sami. Though the most symbolic part of their dress, the kakti, a high-collared tunic, is now normally made of wool rather than reindeer fur. Their varying, resplendent colours can tell you what tribe a Sami is from, and the shape of the hammered tin ornaments even reveal whether they're single or married. Observing the herd, we notice that only some of the reindeers have antlers, and are surprised to learn that it's the females who sport the horns this time of the year. The males grow their antlers in spring and use them to fight and compete with other bulls, as they're known. The bigger the bull's antlers, the higher he sits in the hierarchy. Come late autumn, however, the antlers naturally fall off, and the females will often eat them once discarded, so full of nutrients and minerals that they are.
They drop the antlers once a year. The males drop them before Christmas, after they had the mating season, because they're really huge and they're heavy to carry over the snow. The females will keep the antlers all winter until they give birth to a new calf in May. So the females are the strong one during all winter. They will chase away the males, and even the calf have little antlers and will chase away the males. They are really strong and independent animals, and they take care of themselves first. If there's food, they will eat themselves first, and then the calf will eat. And if one calf gets away from the mother, nobody else will adopt it.
With the reindeer fed and content, we huddle around the fire in the luva, a teepee-like tent, for a wholesome serving of reindeer stew. Nils, also a reindeer herder, shows us some of the traditional wares the men carry. Among them is a small knife called a buiku, passed down from father to son. The transition between generations is an integral part of Sami's family-centric culture. But it is more in danger than it's ever been. Blemishing the snowy landscape is a steel oil rig rising high into the sky. The Sami traditionally herd their reindeer wherever they can. Andre, Luna and Nils work on government-owned land, but are being pushed out in favour of oil prospectors. There is no legal case for them to present, but they're putting up a fight nonetheless. To protect this land from exploitation and demonstrate that it has cultural value far more precious than any oil, they've opened themselves up to the winter tourists flooding into Tromsø every year. Daily groups of inquisitive visitors from Japan, the US, UK and beyond arrive to feed, pet and engage with the reindeer and learn about Sami ways. It's a lamentable story, especially for such an anciently rooted people, but the battle's not yet lost. The Sami are a nomadic civilization. Just as the reindeer's antlers grow again come spring, so too will the Sami raise up a new home wherever the land proves fertile. Holding the buiku and finishing the story with a melancholy look, Nils slowly begins to sing the traditional Sami song, the joik. The deep sound is a free-flowing melody without beginning, end, set style or subject. It can be about anything you like. The only rule, and what a virtuous one it is, you cannot joik about yourself.
Hey yo lo le lo la lo la le lo le lo la lo lo le lo la lo la le lo le lo.
For Monocle, I'm Melkon Çarçoğlu'n from Tromsø.
Melkon Çarçoğlu'n there, reporting from Tromsø in Norway. And don't forget, that story and many others are available to pick up and read in this week's Winter Weekly, available on newsstands and via subscriptions now at monocle.com. You're listening to the Winter Weekly.
We love a chat about good reads here on The Weekly, and last week we heard from one of the wonderful minds behind London store Libreria.
But as book lovers, we're pleased to say they've got strong competition. Today, we're joined by Brett Wollstonecroft of London institution Daunt Books. He's here to talk us through some of the best winter reads, be they for your own perusal or perhaps a gift for some other lucky bookworm this Christmas.
Brett, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Very good to have
Pleasure
you
to
with
here.
Us. Let's start with a title very close to Daunt's heart, the excellently named Christmas with Dull People.
That's right.
Tell us what this is about. I guess the clue's in the name, I guess.
Yeah, it's a little collection by H.H. Munro, otherwise known as Saki, who I think is better known again now. There was a time when he was almost the forgotten sort of short story writer and satirist, and Woodhouse had this great long rediscovery and expansion. But Saki, I think, is wonderful. He's darker, he's funnier, for my book, than many of the stories of people like Woodhouse. And people like Will Self have championed him, I think, quite a lot in recent years as well. And this is four of Saki's Christmas stories, which we put together. We published an earlier little selection, so this is a sort of follow-on from that. And Saki writes wonderful, wicked short stories, but his Christmas stories, I think, are particularly superb in that I think they reflect all our experiences at one time or another of the sort of dreadful Christmas with the people you can't stand. I think particularly if you're staying in other people's houses where they have, you know, unusual and strange traditions. I mean, it's always stressful staying at someone else's house. Staying at a house at Christmas, I think, is your worst nightmare if you don't know what's going on and if you've got crushingly dull relatives to stay. We've all had it, and Saki nails it perfectly, and particularly nails pretentiousness and snobbery and entitlement in a rather wonderful way. I think he's a super, super writer.
Would you recommend this book as perhaps a pointed gift for one of those relatives?
I was going to say, it's a bit risky, isn't it?
That's the problem. We did obviously, it's actually our title. So it's a quote from Saki in one of the stories here. I think the opening of the first story, where he talks about, it's one of the Reginald stories. Reginald is a wonderful sort of, I don't know, sort of anti-Bertie Wooster, I'd call him. He's a much darker version of Bertie Wooster. He's a sort of dilettante, he's the grit in the sort of, in the mill, as it were, of your country house party. And Reginald says somewhere in there that, just look at the opening chapter, because it really sets the book up. And he says something like, they say there's nothing sadder than victory except defeat. But if you've ever stayed with dull people during what is alleged to be the festive season, you can probably revise that saying. I think you have to read that in a sort of a Will Self sort of,
yeah,
ironic drawl,
because
that's very clearly the way that sort of Reginald sort of speaks. And there's a range of them there. There are two Reginald stories. There are two other ones. Title, yes, a risky one, I think, for us as a publisher as well as a bookshop. But that's where us being booksellers, I think, comes in, because we know that that will capture people's imagination and will sell the book. But it does reflect really what Saki's sort of trying to say in there about how ghastly it can be, and that sometimes you need someone to sort of upset the apple cart.
It's good indeed. Disruptors, I believe they're called in modern parlance.
Absolutely, yeah.
Brett, let me ask you, I mean, obviously you've got a huge array of titles, and we're going to talk about some of these in just a second, but on that point, this is quite an exciting time of year. Obviously, I guess people come into the store, and we've championed the cause of Dawn, obviously, just around almost literally a stone's throw from where we are. What kind of questions do they ask you? I mean, presumably someone doesn't come in and say, Brett, I'd really like to send something that will truly eviscerate my the in-laws this Christmas.
Well,
what have you got?
What's
the sort of tenor of the questions you get?
Yeah, I'd like to think they don't say anything specific as that. I think the nightmare for booksellers this time of year is they really do come in and say, it's a present for a friend, he's 52, he's a scientist, but he likes books on politics, and somehow think we're magically going to come up with the exact title. And of course, the art of good bookselling is to almost forget all of that and simply pick the one or two really interesting books, perhaps like this, that you know most people will enjoy, and really avoid the question. I think it's a curious, as us as booksellers, we never really understand why people ask such specific questions when they come in. But it is an exciting time. It's when our best booksellers, you know, come into their own. Mm. It's when you'll get the letters back saying, thank you so much for helping me solve all my present problems. present problems, as in.
I was going to say, why don't you do that as well?
We'd love to do the other things as well. Actually, there's a book which sort of might talk about in a minute, which aims to solve all your problems through poetry, which is another little interesting.
Could be one for you, Henry, I think.
Yeah, are you suggesting that I have more problems than the average man?
I think they're problems that maybe only poetry could solve. Shall we talk about that?
I think it is a time of year where you go into a bookshop and you slightly lay bare your soul because you're really saying, help me, I've no idea.
So you find, are you then sort of therapist as much as...
Well, it's the great book therapy time. Yeah. If that ever does come true, and that was a great idea, wasn't it, 2-3 years ago, we were going to have book therapists who were going to go out there and sell books to you. But it is that time of year where people really do need help. We're all so busy. You've got to get a lot of books. They're great presents. And I think a good bookshop like us can solve most of those problems if you give us a few minutes. Yeah.
Let's move on. Maybe should we dip into the other pile? Or you have
Year of Wonder
you have there. Well,
that's a book which I think every year as booksellers we see books which have clearly been aimed at the Christmas market. And so you become quite a cynic with looking at the sort of publishing. And there are some books which you initially look at and you see and think, that's going to be that publisher's Christmas book. This deserves a much harder look. It's Clemency Burton Hill's Year of Wonder, Classical Music for Every Day. And the idea, I guess, is nothing revolutionary. It is a piece of music for every day of the year. It's really just all in the style. It's fascinating. Tidbits about a particular music, piece of music or composer. But it's a nice little sort of interesting bites and nuggets. It's beautifully done, and certainly I wouldn't mind that as a present.
There you go.
Reginald, in one of those stories here, is on how dreadful Christmas presents can be. And I think he talks in there, the worst thing in the world he's getting, Saki often says this, I think the third best edition of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. It's one of Saki's kind of running jokes. This is much, much better than that.
That's good. Well, and so, Clemency actually was an erstwhile collaborator of ours here at Monocle 24.
Yeah,
she's too busy for us, sadly.
No, she's lovely.
She's very good.
She's absolutely lovely. And of course, we are slightly swayed sometimes by how lovely authors are. I wouldn't pretend we weren't. So,
shall we move on to the anticipated Poetry Pharmacy?
Yeah, William C.
It's a good-looking book as well, isn't it?
It's a pretty book. A really beautiful little a bright orange book. You can't miss it on the shelves. And it does what it says on the front, I guess. It is prescriptions in terms of poetry for curing all our ills.
What's the organising principle here? Is there is a poem per ailment?
It's a poem for curing each ailment. So, for instance, lethargy, we've got Nobody by Michael Lasky, poem I don't know. And then you've got, for instance, For Fear of the Other, you've got No Man is an Island by John Donne, which I would say is pretty sort of spot on. So it's got that kind of accuracy all the way through. So if you've got a broken heart... no doubt somewhere in here there's something for drunkenness as well. So you can tie it all back to Christmas.
There's some nice themes running through, aren't there? Yeah.
Heartbreak, divorce, all cured in a single poem.
Do they have dealing with dullards? Is that in there? Something along those lines,
aging
one imagines.
Aging parents.
Oh, yeah, they could be on the list, couldn't they?
Parental protectiveness, all these things, unkindness, which we're bound to encounter at Christmas. So I would say, it doesn't say it's a Christmas book, but I'd say this is a perfect Christmas book.
There's good utility so far.
Yeah, and nicely done. And actually, genuinely, he did this, I think he used to do it live. I think initially it was a kind of show that he did where he would take questions from the audience. I think it later developed into a blog once we sort of hit the net age. But principle's the same. And I think these are the kind of things which, if you do them lazily, and publishers do sometimes do these things lazily, are dreadful. But if you do it properly and wholeheartedly, which he certainly has...
Do you mean kind of themed anthologies?
Themed anthologies and Christmas anthologies of poetry can be dreadfully lazy things. But this is a real labour of love. And everything is really, well thought through and well chosen. And, it's a beautiful book, nicely done. Mm. And I think that, again, nice gift.
It's nice to have those things that are, the antithesis to the sort of publishing by numbers, which you can, understandably, perhaps, but forget at this time of year.
And I think this year has been a year where that is, I think everybody is largely saying that we've perhaps been manipulated too much in recent years by publishers with, this year it's going to be Hugo, whatever you want to pronounce it, and Lagom this year, whatever it is. And this year, I think a few more kind of indies have broken through, largely on quality, looks and style, and I think that's great for us as a bookshop. That's great. Yeah.
Now, if everyone was talking Hugo and Lagom and so forth, will they be talking Kilted Yoga on into the
they
future,
will be
Brett? I have to
they
ask
will
you.
Be talking Kilted Yoga, and actually it's the same thing. I mean, it looks, this got a fantastic picture of Finlay Wilson, who's the author of it, not quite laid bare, but at least with just his kilt on, or at least I assume he's a Scotsman, so it is just his kilt on. A fantastic photograph, as they all are. of this complete lunatic doing yoga in some of Scotland's most beautiful places. Odd enough, it's the same thing. I mean, if you like looking at sort of bearded men in kilts, which of course I do, it's a wonderful book and a wonderful sight and a wonderful beard, then great. But actually, he is deadly serious. This has become a huge kind of sensation. But he's really just using it to kind of publicise the benefits of yoga.
Well, I was just saying, is kilted yoga, does it diverge from conventional yoga in any substantive way?
Yeah, it does in a substantive way. And that you see the picture there, he's got to use one hand to hold the...
Well, I was going to say, there are some logistical questions wearing a kilt in the traditional way with some of the moves.
That's the humour, and his socks there are clearly hiding something there. Yes, I mean, again, it is actually wholehearted. I mean, he discovered this. He thought this would be an interesting way to sort of publicise what he was doing, he and his colleague. They got millions of hits. Colleague, yeah.
Okay.
I don't think you want colleagues anywhere near you if you're wearing a kilt with nothing underneath it.
Each to his own, I guess.
But it's a bit of fun, but actually it's a wholehearted look at that, and it's very unpretentious. It publicises yoga. It's properly done. It's actually a rather pretty little book, oddly enough. As I say, if you like bearded Scotsmen.
And who doesn't?
And who doesn't?
Nowadays. Yeah.
But it is good fun. I think, again, could be looked at as a kind of frivolous, gifty book. Actually rather nice.
Exactly. Yeah. And listen, we're no enemies of frivolity here. Right? Let's be clear. You've got another pile of books there. From the top down, should we do? What have you got here?
I would put this one probably, you know, if we were picking out one or two of the books which have been a big hit for us this year, and an important book, I think, a book called Silence in the Age of Noise by Erling Kagger. He's he's actually an explorer generally, but he's famous particularly for solo, unsupported trips across the Antarctic. And naturally enough, he had time while he was doing that to meditate on silence, but on being alone. And again, it's a book which could stray into sort of self-helpy nothingness, but actually he's thought about it very carefully. And he was trying to persuade his daughters that if you really want to understand the world or yourself, you know, just try cutting everything out, all the distractions. It's a kind of digital disconnect idea, but an enforced one, I think, in his case.
And there's a cover quote from Robert McFarlane, of course. I've forgotten the name of his... No. But he espouses this sort of idea of...
The old ways is probably perhaps the most recent huge hit.
This idea of escaping. It's a bit appealing, particularly this time of year, isn't it?
Yeah, becoming one completely with your environment. I think in his case, he really is looking at this thing of, can you ever find absolute and true silence? Mm. And what does it do to you in terms of thinking and thought when you do it? But it's just one of those books you think, well, surely I only need a page or two of this, but you find you've read the whole book by the time you finish. So,
Brett, I'm interested, as you approach the festive season, obviously people are looking to buy a book for Christmas, but they're also going to be reading it looking into the new year. Mm. And one kind of pedal tone that I've seen running through the books we've discussed so far is they are, in the broader sense of the word, prescriptive.
Yeah.
Do you find an uptick in books of that type being brought out in time for Christmas, New Year? People are thinking about changing their lives, maybe?
I'm not sure it's particularly a Christmas thing. That tends to run throughout the year. I mean, the sheer numbers of titles published at this time of year just reflect that run up to Christmas. It's where obviously all the publishing industry throws its trade. I think that desire is definitely there, and that's reflected in taste. Whether the publishing industry, large and amorphous as it is able to kind of focus on that and think that's what we all want to do. A bit of the Hugo thing may have been that sense of you're sitting actually at home. What does home mean to you? And therefore you start to reflect on the fact that that may be much more important than your day-to-day job, and the environment around you, you know, matters enormously. But I think it's more sort of reactive rather than the other way around. Yeah.
Brett, you've got a couple more titles with Christmas in their titles. Should we talk about those?
Yeah, I mean, the Christmas anthology, as I say, is a kind of risky thing. If done well, it's great. Giles Brandreth, who is, I think, you know, one of those figures who's a Marmite figure, I think.
I should jump in and say, for our international listeners, probably best to get on the old Google machine, have a quick look at him,
He's a larger-than-life character. I mean, he's got so many sides to him, hasn't he? I mean, he was a Tory MP for a while and actually a very effective whip. He probably wrote the best political diaries, oddly enough, whatever your views on him and his politics, the diaries he wrote are fantastic. And he is an amazing sort of polymath in terms of his interests and knowledge of all sorts of things, particularly literature and so on. It's a good, really well done, beautifully produced book by New Holland, who again have beautiful cloth-bound little books. It is, I think, the one that you give, you know, granddad, and the one you give perhaps your parents. It's what they would expect. It's got a really super collection of sort of pieces in here. For instance, Mrs. Beaton on Christmas turkeys and so on, Quentin Crisp. It's really well done. Again, wholehearted and well done.
OK, well, quick fire. You have 20 seconds, Brett, to share with us your last couple. There's last quick, two Christmas
quick fire,
titles.
Again, I needn't say anything other than John Julius Norwich, who produces a little book called Christmas Cracker every year, An English Christmas. It's actually got one of the Saki stories in there. So for me, good taste. And again, well done. Rather like the Brandreth, rather beautifully done. And actually, an interesting sort of different one at the end, Judith Flanders, who is a super, super historian, principally, I guess, of the home and Victorian England in recent years. Christmas, a biography, which looks at how Christmas has changed over the years. She's just really wonderful historian. And I think the interesting thing about it, perhaps above all, is we're always thinking that Christmas was better in the past. That's what comes out of that book. So there's nothing new in it. You go back to 1650 and where they're more or less saying, what happened to Christmas? You know, where did it go? Why has it become so different? So nice to know nothing changes.
Can we end perhaps with the sort of back cover quote on the An English Christmas book edited by John Julius Norwich, which has Scrooge indignant. Yeah. Every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. I feel we've provided the opposite of that, though, haven't we?
Would endorse that to a T.
Lovely stuff. Brett, it's fabulous to speak with you. Thanks for coming to see us.
Thank you very much.
Henry Rees Sheridan, what a delight it has been to co-chair this inaugural Monocle Winter Weekly audio offer alongside you. Lovely stuff. What fun Malcolm was having. I did feel a bit sorry for the Sami people and for the reindeer, but that's another story. Delicious cheese, even more delicious intellectual sustenance with Brett. I feel positively, warmly embraced by the Weekly this week.
I believe the Winter Weekly is going to be returning, is that right?
That's right. Each week that the Winter Weekly newspaper hits newsstands, this Winter Weekly will be hitting the airwaves. Today's programme was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and Anna Sinfield. My thanks, Henry, to all of them.
The Monocle Winter Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Henry Rees Sheridan.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.